Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm David LaTulipe, your host. I'll be talking today, or actually, you'll hear from Rose Aguilar, a conversation with choreographer Tania Chianese, artistic director of the Canase Collective, and Heather Arnett, the leader of the Cat Call Choir, to discuss Nevertheless, which surveys the field of gender-based harassment from the subtle to the violent in a marriage of song and dance, comedy and horror. Rose's conversation will be complemented by a live performance that was just recorded last hour here of the Cat Call Choir. From the chamber chorus Sacred and Profane, we'll hear about their concerts this weekend from artistic director Rebecca Seaman. Part of Elemental Forces, the choir's 41st season. I'll also talk by phone with composer David Shire, who will be visiting San Francisco State this weekend to give master classes and to coach students in musical theater performance, composition, libretto, and scoring. On Broadway, David Shire and lyricist Richard Maltby wrote the scores for the musicals Baby and Big. David is also well known for his film scores to The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3, The Conversation, and All the President's Men, among many others. In conversation with David will be composer Steve Horowitz from San Francisco State, who is joining me in studio. Also, our regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, reports on playwright Lance Belleville's new play, Scott and Zelda, The Beautiful Fools, which opens April 12th at the Ross Valley Players, and a preview of the documentary film, They Shall Not Grow Old, directed and produced by Peter Jackson, who used original footage of World War I from the Imperial War Museum's archives, most of it previously unseen, together with historical audio from the BBC and interviews with British servicemen who fought in the conflict. And Rose Aguilar does double duty this week with a brief review of Volta by Cirque du Soleil, now through March 24th under the Big Top in San Jose. That's music from the chamber chorus Sacred and Profane. The theme of their 2018-19 season is Elemental Forces and continues this Friday here in San Francisco with additional performances in Berkeley on Saturday and Sunday in Alameda. These concerts, The American Landscape, Traditional Music and Art of the United States, invites you to travel the highways and byways of this vast country's diverse musical and artistic landscapes. Several local visual artists will add their perspectives to the chorus's music, which includes selections from Folk Song Mass by Japanese-American composer Paul Chihara, arrangements of Amish folk songs by Mark Templeton, African-American spirituals arranged by Moses Hogan and Stacy Gibbs, and more, including, as we just heard, Sean Kirshner's music, an excerpt from his Unclouded Day song cycle. To delve deeper into the concerts, I'm pleased to welcome Sacred and Profane's artistic director and conductor since 2004, Rebecca Seaman. Rebecca is a Bay Area native, currently on the faculty in the Performing Arts and Social Justice Department at the University of San Francisco, where she conducts the classical choral ensembles and teaches private voice as well as courses in music history and theory. In addition to her work with classical music, Rebecca is co-producer of a documentary film about folk music impresario Izzy Young, currently in production. And she, we'll have to talk about this. She regularly performs with her wine glass organ. Rebecca Seaman, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I understand that was a the recording we heard was fresh off the presses, so to speak. Or
yeah,
fresh
recorded
from the rehearsal
hall. At our dress rehearsal last night. Yeah, we're very excited about this concert. I've rarely seen the ensemble this involved throughout their bodies and voices. They're just singing beautifully.
Well, how did the program come together to incorporate both art and music?
Oh, yeah. Well, the initiation for the program came from, you know, previous programs that we've done on American composers, and I felt like there were so many people in the discipline that are really working with traditional American music, you know, of the various sort of indigenous and traditional areas that we have in American music. So I wanted to do a program focused on Americana. And we thought, you know, as we're sort of delving into all of these vernacular music traditions, that we have so many vernacular artistic traditions as well that are born here in the United States. We have a number of visual artists who are professional, who are in the ensemble. And so we reached out to a variety of these people and received funding and support from the city of Alameda in order to really make that project come to fruition. Mm-hmm. So we're looking forward to sort of incorporating this whole idea of American art as a broad perspective, because the American identity is a very broad perspective. So we have people in ceramics, people in painting, people doing collage work. We have people who are working in textile art. We have a glass maker who does beautiful glass work. So we're really excited about the breadth of that work as well as the breadth of the traditional music that we're singing in the program.
The Sunday performances and activities will be at the First Presbyterian Church of Alameda on Sunday evening at 7, and that's
right
on Santa Clara Avenue in Alameda.
Correct. And also just to make a correction, the San Francisco Chronicle printed an error for our concert on Friday night in San Francisco.
Shame on them.
Yes, so I just wanted to send that out to the public here. The concert is actually I think they're correct. So we're in San Francisco. We are at 7 p.m. this coming Friday at St. Francis Lutheran on Church Street.
They got that information from your website.
That one they got correct. Saturday we're in Berkeley at St. Mark's Episcopal at 8 p.m. Uh-huh. So 8 p.m. for both of those concerts, Friday
right.
and Saturday. And Sunday our concert is at 7 p.m., right. not the printed 4 p.m. So just to make that clear out there in the world.
And, of course, you can find more details through a link at our website, at our Open Air page, and their sacredprofane.org website, sacredprofane.org. Let's hear some more music, and then we'll talk more about the basics of Sacred Profane.
Great.
What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Stacey Gibbs' Soon I Will Be Done. Stacey is a really wonderful arranger of African-American spirituals. His music is much in circulation right now.
And then more with Rebecca Seaman.
No trouble, no trouble, no trouble, no trouble, no trouble.
Stacy Gibbs' arrangement there that you'll hear as part of the American Landscape Traditional Music and Art of the United States this weekend with Sacred and Profane Chorus, joined by Rebecca Seaman here. Wonderful sound that you're getting out of that chorus.
Thank you.
Let's delve down a little bit into how the chorus was founded. And the Bay Area is such a rich area for a variety of choruses. Everyone seems to have found their niche, and
we're blessed here.
Incredibly blessed by that.
It's one of the really the best choral communities in the country. So I'm so grateful to be a part of that community. It's really fantastic.
And so how do you get those people to come to your choir? Or are you are people doing multiple gigs, so to speak?
There are definitely a couple of people in my ensemble that sing in other groups, but I think for most of them, this is their choral commitment. This is where they find their home. You know, I think all of the groups in the area try to find a way that we can express our unique vision. For Sacred and Profane, we're really trying to be a community group for high-level amateur singers, singers that could be singing, or many could be singing at a professional level, but that's not their professional emphasis right now. So they're coming to the group with a lot of strong skills, but we're coming to it from a non-professional place. So there's a different level of commitment. We're really doing this from the heart, from, you know, a place of just love of the music. We want to sing a wide variety, a large breadth of repertoire. So, for example, this concert is a different kind of timbre than we typically approach, or than we often approach when we're singing early music or 20th century composition that requires a different sort of tonal construction for the ensemble and for the voice. And they're really loving it. They're loving letting themselves go and delve into that. But we're looking for that diversity. We're looking for that authenticity of performance and experience for both the singers and for our audiences. We want to show the breadth of the choral tradition, mm-hmm. including 19th century music, which tends to get left behind sometimes.
And does the chorus maintain a core number of people? Is it supplemented at times by soloists or people from outside the chorus?
Rarely. I try to pull my soloists from the choir. We have people in the ensemble that have the skill level to sing solo repertoire really beautifully at that level. So in this concert, we have two or three solos that are being sung in a way that I feel is fully on par with professional groups in town. Just absolutely beautiful work. On occasion, if we're doing a big masterwork, I might pull in soloists from outside, but generally speaking, I try to give those opportunities to my singers. We're a traditional chamber choir size. We tend to be around 30, give or take, singers, where we are in that particular set and their numbers. We've done well with keeping singers involved over the years. But there are always openings in the group for those singers that are out there that would like to come and audition.
Well, there you go. Go to sacredprofane.org to learn more and about these concerts Friday here in San Francisco at St. Francis Lutheran at 8, Saturday also at 8 at St. Mark's Episcopal in Berkeley, Sunday the 10th at 7 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church of Alameda. The Alameda performances, once again, will be an interdisciplinary experience, free to the public, featuring an exhibit on the theme of the American landscape with works by glass artist Kim Webster, textile artists Georgianne Bowers and Alice Beasley, painter Michelle Frederick, and mixed media artists Ake and Leslie Grumditz, supported by a generous grant from the City of Alameda. Congratulations on that. Let's hear some more music as we transition here. What are we going to hear?
I thought we'd go out with the last piece of Kirchner's Heavenly Home Cycle. This one is called Hallelujah.
Thanks for coming in, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Thank you.
music from Sacred Profane Chorus. Their concerts on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Information at sacredprofane.org. My guest, Rebecca, that performance, Rebecca Seaman, their longtime director. Learn more about the concerts, sacredprofane.org. Lots more to come here on KALW and Open Air. Stay with us. Some of the music from The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, the classic film starring Walter Matthau, capturing brilliantly the grit and grime and action of New York City. We'll talk with David Shire shortly. I'm also pleased to welcome Steve Horowitz to our studios and David Shire by phone. Steve is a composer, producer, and bass player, perhaps best known for his original score to the Academy Award-nominated film Super Size Me. He's also the creative artist behind 23 albums of original music and writes for classical ensembles, dance, film, TV, cartoons, and video games. As audio director at Nickelodeon Digital, Steve has literally worked on hundreds of games and interactive projects. He was honored with a Grammy Award for his engineering work on the compact disc True Life Blues, The Songs of Bill Monroe, back in 1996, and is the co-author of The Essential Guide to Game Audio, The Theory and Practice of Sound for Games, published by Focal Press. He studied music composition with Morton Sabotnick and is lecturer in composition, music for games, and music for film at SF State. Steve, welcome.
Great to be here with you.
He is hosting the multi-award-winning composer David Shire to the campus. David has composed prolifically for the theater, films, TV, and recordings, and on Broadway. On Broadway, he and lyricist Richard Maltby wrote the Tony-nominated scores for the musicals Baby and Big. His off-Broadway scores, also written with Maltby, and with whom he continues to collaborate, includes a favorite of mine, Starting Here, Starting Now, which received a Grammy nomination. For the stage, his music has been heard at the New York Shakespeare Festival and Lincoln Center, among many other stages here and abroad. And his many feature film scores include Norma Rae, which won an Academy Award for Best Song with lyrics by Norman Gimbel, Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation, All the President's Men, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, Short Circuit, 2010, Farewell, My Lovely, The Hindenburg, Return to Oz, and Saturday Night Fever, for which his work earned 2 Grammy Awards. We'll run out of time if I continue with his resume, so let's get the conversation started. David, thank you for taking some time by phone today prior to your cross-country flight.
It's a pleasure.
Well, let's get Steve into the conversation right off and how you two got to know each other.
That's a really great story. So I had just finished doing Super Size Me, and I went out to Los Angeles. I was living in New York at the time, although I went to high school out here in Berkeley High, and I was living in Manhattan. Super Size Me went to the Academy Awards. I was running around meeting agents and talking to people, and I happened to be in the same room with David's agent at the time, and I was working on this piece. I had found a CD of The Taking of Pelham, or of Pelham 1-2-3, in the CD shop, and just felt I loved it. It was felt completely fell in love with that score. And so I was in his agent's office, and I was like, I'd love to get in touch with David and let him know about this project I'm working on. I actually thought David lived in Los Angeles at the time, and they're like, sure. And I sent him a total fanboy email. I really love your music, Mr. Shire, and it would be fantastic if you would maybe take a listen to what I'm working on, and maybe you would give me a quote for the CD, you know, when it's ready to come out, when the project is done. We were putting it on at that point at the kitchen, and then we later did it in Los Angeles. And I got a phone call from David. He emailed me, and he said, well, give me a call, you know. And I'm like, great. And he actually turned out David was up in Nyack, and just amazing. And he told me that he liked it, and we started a friendship from there. He's on the phone, so I'm probably making him feel uncomfortable.
David, what did you think of this upstart guy who contacted you that way?
Well, I don't have that many fanboys, so it's a pleasure. And I remember the letter being very nice, the call being very nice. And he had an interesting idea about doing something called the retaking of Pelham 123, and invited me to a concert he was giving with his group. I think it was Steve Budd, 10 players.
Yeah, about a 12-piece ensemble, yeah.
And he had kind of brought it up to date, made me sound even hipper. really like. And we've had an on and off friendship ever since.
Yeah. I mean, do you remember what you said to me on the phone when I called you up and told you we were doing it at the kitchen in sort of avant-garde circles?
I hope it was clean.
No, you said to me, I've always wanted to be associated with the avant-garde.
Oh, right. Well,
there you go.
Which made me laugh because I was like, well, you know, yeah. The money's better on your side of the fence.
Yeah.
Well, that score we just heard a taste of for Pelham 123 really does capture that the whole mood of the film of 1970s New York. David, could you share with us a little bit about how much the director of a film is involved in your process? Or is it completely, this is the music you're getting, mister?
It really varies from film to film. It can be total indifference, like, here's the picture, go home and write the score, to a very close collaboration,
really
which
noisy.
Usually is the best way to work, which can be very fruitful. For instance, with Francis Coppola on The Conversation, we was working on the film while they were shooting it, so I had a very intimate involvement with it, and Francis gave me very clear direction, which helped me to find the music for it. On Pelham, I remember we spotted it, and I hardly ever talked to Joe Sargent again until the recording session.
Wow. Are you given some sort of limitations to take into consideration, or are you told, no, you can't have 8 French horns and 50 strings? Or you hopefully get away with it, so to speak, depending on your inspiration.
Can you say that again? My cell phone went off and totally blocked everything you said.
Oh, that's all right. Are impositions or restrictions put on you? For instance, you can't use 8 French horns and 50 strings, or do you write for what's in your heart first and then see what happens?
No, the budget is usually almost always very clearly out, and you have to work within that. Also, Francis, who had a big budget on Conversation, just wanted a piano score.
Mm.
So
mm.
Although I had my heart set on a big orchestra because that was my first kind of high-profile film, I was quite disappointed when he said, I hear a piano score, but it worked out great.
It certainly did. If you haven't seen The Conversation, do check it out. Amazing, amazing film. Now, you've been writing for so long, David. Thank you, first of all. A career that we could safely say goes back to the rotary dial phone era. And so you've seen a great deal of change on the technological front. Have your techniques changed with the resources that are now available? Or do you still have, or did you ever have, an old school blank manuscript at the piano approach to writing?
My work process has changed radically. When I started, it was look at the film on a moviola and call the music editor in the middle of the night to put up reels when you wanted to check out a scene. And you had cue sheets and no synthesizers. And now I can create, I do a lot of indie films lately, and with low budgets, but I can deliver a reasonable reasonably good sounding orchestral score, working in my own home studio with synthesizers. I do all my composition on program called Finale, which I think Steve is very familiar with.
Sure, I as well here on the radio front. You've kept up with the technological times. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I was lucky because when I started working at really doing television and film scores and mainly, I was working at Universal, and synthesizers were just coming in. And the big hot number was the ARP 2600, which was monophonic, and we thought it was really wonderful. And compared to what we have now with polyphonic synthesizers and samples, it was kind of a dinosaur.
Mm.
I got in just under the wire of being able to grow up with the technology, and as the new technology came out, I was able to, you know, move up. I'm afraid at my age now, if I had to start from scratch, I wouldn't start.
Actually, no, David, you'd be hip again because, you know, all analog synthesis is completely the rage these days.
Yeah, I know. I get a big kick out of the fact that they offer samples of old, digital samples of old acoustic synthesizers.
Yeah, no, I walk into the studios at SF State, and people are plugging patch cables back into Euro racks, and it's a...
And LPs are coming back.
So yeah, I still
everything old is new again.
Hopefully, 8-tracks won't make it back though.
Certain technologies were never meant to return.
So, David, tell us a little bit how a workshop with you would work.
You mean like I'm going to be doing it at San Francisco?
Haven't even discussed this yet. We were going to talk about this soon.
Well, there you go. Here's the opportunity is now. Well,
it can be different depending on whether it's how technically knowledgeable the students are. I like the best kind is when I can talk to really, really somewhat experienced musicians, so I can talk about the nuts and bolts of a specific score. I like thinking about how I came to the Pelham score, which involved atonal techniques, and the conversation, which was a totally different score. You can't teach composition, but you can show students how you solve certain problems.
Mm-hmm. Do you also point them to folks like Rimsky-Korsakov and the great classical arrangers for use of instruments?
Oh, is that about Rimsky-Korsakov?
Do you point them to composers like Rimsky-Korsakov, who was such a master of orchestration in the use of various instruments?
It depends. Sometimes I point them towards Little Richard. I mean, it depends on the film. That's another thing about how films change. Mm-hmm. Film scoring has changed so much. When I started there, we were just out of the golden age of film scoring, you know, the Dmitri Tiomkins and that Korngold, that school. But jazz was starting to make a heavy entrance into the toolkit of film composers. And from then on, it's gotten more and more hybrid with rock scores and on one end, and John Williams' huge classical scores on the other end.
Or
anything goes now. And what I tell film students is they've got to be ready to do almost anything.
Right. Well, in addition to working with the solo piano, as you did for Coppola, we're going to go out with some music from the conversation. Tell us how you kept people's interest as you were had to do the whole score for piano.
You mean on the conversation? When we were mixing the picture, we fed the piano through ARP 2600, that I mentioned before, and with ring modulation and other techniques, we're able to vary the piano sound and make it a little weirder as the movie weirder, the piano sound did.
Speaking of that weirdness of the movie, we're going to have Steve set up the music for us and the film. And we wish you a safe flight back to this coast for a visit. And I hope you inspire a whole new generation of composers.
Yeah, one thing definitely to point out, too, is that the Friday night concert, which is Friday the 15th, so a week from this Friday, is completely free and open to the public. David will be performing live with the Alexander String Quartet.
Fantastic.
As well as the San Francisco State Wind Ensemble, led by Brad Hogarth. So it's going to be a basically an evening-long tribute to David and his music in a very number of different ways with a wonderful performers, singers from the School of Theater and Dance. So,
Thanks again for taking time today, David.
Thank you.
And so the conversation.
The conversation. I mean, it's a wonderful score. It follows Gene Hackman as he goes through this movie. And what David's talking about that's really interesting to me about this score is it starts out with this wonderful moody piano theme. If we remember Gene Hackman's character in the film, he's listening to jazz all the time. In that movie, but as he gets deeper and deeper into sort of his personal problems in the film, like David was talking about, I had always wondered about this too. You know, I thought there was more to the score than just piano, but yeah, they had taken the piano, run it through electronics, and done all sorts of things to alter it, so it doesn't even sound like a piano anymore. Mm-hmm. So we're listening to the piano parts here, but it's a fascinating, wonderful score. Great film. I think it's David has said it's one of the films that even though he was upset that he didn't get to do a big orchestral score for it, it's one of the scores that people have come back to him most as one of his most popular scores.
Links to David's website as well as what Steve is up to is at our website, Open Air. You can learn about the events that are happening for this tribute to David Shire. Thanks so much for coming in, Steve.
Thank you for having us. It's great. Fantastic.
Music of David Shire from The Conversation, Francis Ford Coppola-directed fascinating film. In an odd coincidence of booking guests, both the teams behind Your Call with Rose Aguilar and my one-man team of Neil Swinkles scheduled the women behind the Canese Collective and Cat Call Choir for segments today. Rose did such a comprehensive job talking with them, I thought I'd share that with you in brief excerpt. It will be followed by a live performance that was recorded just earlier this morning by the Cat Call Choir.
It's also been turned into a dance performance by the performing arts ensemble Canese, a collective with music by the Cat Call Choir. In the performance, which debuts tonight in San Francisco, artists tackle gender-based harassment with song and dance, comedy, and horror. It features 25 singers and dancers performing 17 vignettes exploring gender discrimination, harassment, and sexual violence. Nevertheless, we'll also include a companion gallery installation from Bay Area and national artists who explore similar themes in their work. Joining us to talk about how creative expression challenges harassment are three guests. Tanya Canese is a choreographer and founder and artistic director of the performing arts ensemble Canese Collective. And Tanya joins us in studio. Hi, Tanya. Welcome to the show.
Rose, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Allison Buganim, a sculptor. I wanted to get that right. Her project, Wax That Ass, is a series of interactive butt sculptures that combat and comment on sexual harassment. The sculptures, which are made out of actual women's butts, incorporate technology and have buttons and sensors that once touched project different sounds and phrases. Hi, Allison. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Heather Arnett, director of the Cat Call Choir, which sets real cat calls and commentary to the tunes of children's rhymes and other well-known songs. Heather created the Cat Call Choir to use humor and storytelling to combat the anger and the frustration that so many of us experience when we are harassed. Heather, nice to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Great to have all of you. All of their work will be featured in Nevertheless, which runs for four performances at Z Space in San Francisco, Thursday, March 7th, March 8th, March 9th at 8 p.m. That's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and then a matinee on Sunday at 2 p.m. The gallery installation is open 2 hours prior to every performance and is free to the public. I want to start off by asking you all, just on a personal level, how you have been affected by Me Too. I mean, it's still happening. I was just reading about Ryan Adams, the musician who has been accused of sexual harassment, and he just canceled, I believe it's his European tour. So this just, I was reading about the New York Ballet in New York. It just continues to happen. I just wonder how you have all been affected by that personally. Tanya, let's start off with you.
Well, we began this process in 2016 before the hashtag MeToo movement got that big wave of attention. It's been around for a while, but so it was really interesting to be in this process, thinking about this every day, doing a lot of research, talking in rehearsals, and then for all of this to come to the forefront of our conversation in this country and everybody talking about this. So because I've been thinking almost nonstop about this topic for 2 years, two and a half years, I'm not necessarily surprised by anything. It's just sort of a continuation, which is really difficult, but here we are. Mm. But I'm so thankful that the conversation is at the forefront of all of our minds.
Allison, what would you add?
Yeah, I think that the conversations that are being had and brought to everyone's attention are so powerful, and the fact that we can all come together and acknowledge that I think that like harassment in some form is like a universally like woman's issue, and that we've all experienced some spectrum of it. And so the fact that we can all come together and recognize that we have this shared experience, and finally we can talk about how it's not okay and accepting it as our like new normal, and addressing that it's finally time to stop accepting this.
I mean, in many ways, you just reminded me, Tanya, that it's hard to even keep up. Because I mentioned Ryan Adams and the New York Ballet, and then there was that R. Kelly interview where he got up and started yelling during an interview with Gayle King. So it's hard to actually keep up with how fast this is moving. What would you add, Heather? How has this all affected you?
I really appreciate how the Me Too wave has demonstrated that critical mass catalyzes change, mm-hmm. and that if you want something to happen, you also have to be a part of it. And we were talking just prior to this interview about how so many different people now feel comfortable sharing their stories, and that they themselves can't even explain why that mm-hmm. they feel comfortable. And I think it is that critical mass, the attention that's being drawn, that says, okay, this is, I now have the freedom to also share my story.
Right. And I was telling you, all of you, about the broadcast we did during the Kavanaugh hearings. And when they took a break, we opened the lines and heard from so many people, mostly older women, who'd never told their stories before. We also heard from an older man who never told his story before. And you've got incredible stories about what you have heard as a result of this performance. But before we talk about that, you all do really incredible work, and I just want to get a little bit of background about your work, what really inspires you. So, Tanya, you are a choreographer and founder of the Kanasi Ensemble. Tell us a little bit about that collective and what really inspires your work.
Sure. Everything that we work on and create and present is surrounding an idea of perspective. The odd name of the company is Kanasi Collective, and the first word is a play on the words can I see, as in what am I looking at, and also my strange Italian last name. And so all of our work brings attention to some, I don't want to say issue, but something, and then hopefully changes our awareness around that topic. So for example, we recently did a show about Marcel Duchamp, the Dada artist who used to take works at the turn of the century and take various everyday items, turn them on their side, put them in an art gallery and say, this is no longer, for example, his famous work, The Urinal, titled Fountain, but instead this entirely different item. So we took hundreds and hundreds of rolls of toilet paper and used that as scenery and costumes and never addressed it as toilet paper, but instead as this billowy item that could be used for all these different mediums. Mm. With this work, we started, 2 years ago, started making work about this topic to bring awareness, and here we are.
And Allison, tell us about your project, Wax That Ass. I was reading a piece about the installation in the Miami Times, and in that piece you said that your experiences growing up in Miami inspired you to create the butts.
Yep, absolutely. So the series was inspired by exactly growing up in Miami and from a very young age experiencing some form of harassment or being catcalled, and me accepting that as like the way of life. I didn't know that life could be different. I didn't know that people weren't supposed to yell at you on the street or supposed to follow you on your way to school or supposed to be so kind of aggressive like that. I thought that was just the way things were supposed to be. And then just being very observant and just like how many strip clubs it took to get to school in my daily routine, or just how many, how often women's bodies were sexualized, and that was just like the default. And growing up that way, it was like very challenging because I didn't know how to challenge it because I didn't know there was another way, but it was also something just so powerful inside of me that was like, I don't want to accept this anymore. I can't accept this. There has to be an alternative. And so that really started the series and me just wanting to kind of fight back the kind of pressures and the patriarchy, whatever, like that was put onto us as being women and being seen as just only as sexual bodies or forms as a means to sell things versus the women, the powerful, beautiful bodies that we really are in our minds and attached to it.
It's a very powerful image to think of you as a high school student walking past five or six strip clubs. Were they open while you were walking past?
Yeah, you'd be surprised how many people go to strip clubs at like 3 in the afternoon. Strip clubs were open, just also just like random signage and like vans. You know how like vans have like blinking advertisement at like just broad daylight in the afternoon, like advertising these strip clubs and other areas like that.
What about you? Tell us a little bit more about the Cat Call Collective.
Cat Call Choir started as a result of
Cat Call Choir.
The need for a more productive response to street harassment. I started documenting just personal cases of harassment in about 2014, and I started doing that just to, I think, prove to myself that it was as bad as I thought it was. And unfortunately, in the documentation, I just started feeling worse, and it made me angrier. I found myself going out looking to be harassed and then, you know, angrily scribbling something down. Wow. And I needed to do something different. And so I took all of the quotes that I had written down, and I created a song to the tune of Brahms' Lullaby, which we now call Lick You Lullaby. So that was the first Cat Call Choir song, and it is comprised of nothing more than quotes from street harassment. And I started singing that song just on the street in the Mission District by myself, and tried to get people to listen, and a few folks would stop and have conversations with me about what I was singing about. And so that's sort of the origin story. And then I got a few women to join me and do a small performance, and it's just magically created itself from that point.
Wow. Heather Arnett is director of the Cat Call Choir, which sets real cat calls and commentary to the tunes of children's rhymes and other well-known songs. Allison Bouganim is a sculptor. Her project, Wax That Ass, is a series of interactive butt sculptures that combat and comment on sexual harassment. And Tanya Kanasi is a choreographer and the founder and artistic director of the performing arts ensemble Kanasi Collective. All of their work will be featured in Nevertheless, which runs for 4 performances at Z Space in San Francisco tonight, Friday night, and Saturday night, 8 o'clock, with a matinee on Sunday at 2 o'clock. There will be a gallery installation open 2 hours prior to every performance, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org.
My thanks to Rose Aguilar for letting me poach that conversation from earlier this morning. And just after her conversation on Your Call, we did feature the Cat Call Choir for a live brief performance, which we're going to share with you now.
Instead, I didn't mean to scare your friend. I'll just follow you instead.
little thing told me thank you for saying that I'd like to see the things that she's half showing only. What else could that possibly mean? Thank you, thank you. She said thank you, goody, ooey, ooey. Thank you, thank you. This totally justifies me. I'm pretty sure that she said thank you when I told her I like your shoes. And by shoes, what I really meant was I'd like to knock around your boobs.
I'd like
knock, knock
your boobs.
Knock, knock.
I'd like to knock around your boobs.
We like showing off our boobs.
I'd like to knock around.
We like showing off.
I like showing off around your boobs.
Thank you, thank you. She said thank you, goody, ooey, ooey. Thank you, thank you. This totally justifies me. She was standing on the subway when he came. She was squashed between the people when he came. She was standing on the subway.
She was squashed between the people.
He was humping her poor behind when he came. She was out walking her doggy one bright day when a boy of just 7 years crept her way. When he smacked her as she whirled around, said, hey, you're just a kid, what gives? He said, you know, with me you want to play.
The Cat Call Choir, as recorded here in studio just this last past hour. The Can I Say Collective and the Cat Call Choir, in association with Z-Space, presents Nevertheless, a Marriage of Song and Dance, Comedy and Horror. Zspace.org for more information.
Well, it may be a long way from or to Tipperary, a long way to go. Goodbye, Piccadilly. Goodbye, Leicester Square. And these words, these songs, this music is very much the spirit of World War One. And I bring it up because running in different cinemas around the Bay Area is Peter Jackson's They Shall Not Grow Old. And this is a sad, emotional, powerful film about war in the trenches, and I think most important, if you have the opportunity, see it at the 3D version. I saw it at Westfield Centre down on Market Street. So what is the story about the filmmaking? What is the story about the history? Peter Jackson is a New Zealander, and New Zealand in 1914, when war was declared, had roughly a population of 1 million people. And of that 1 million, 10%, including nurses and soldiers, were committed to battle in the trenches in 1914. And the price they paid was 17,000 dead, over 41,000 injured, and that is just the New Zealand contingent. So from a historian's point of view, New Zealand was a major contributor and has deep memories of the impact that the First World War had on the country and its countrymen. The movie, They Shall Not Grow Old, really focuses on action on the Western Front and kicks off with a very unusual opening sequence. It is a football game played in England between Germany and a British team. And just halfway through the match, the announcements come that war has been declared, but the players decide they will finish the game. And so, with that sad, tragic opening, we then cut to the fighting in the trenches. And one of the great achievements of Peter Jackson is to turn old-time footage into fast-moving contemporary footage, and he's used a number of skilled technicians who bring 24 frames a second up to different speeds. They've had a colorizer, so what moves from black and white, those old scenes that we all remember, into full color. And then he's had lip sync readers, so that with the troops from different regiments, different parts of England, he is read their lips, found people with appropriate accents, and they are talking to each other. Now, I mentioned at the beginning it is a highly emotional and sad movie. And at one point, when you see a platoon going over the top out of the trenches into battle, the commentator says, in the next 30 minutes, all these people would be dead. And I think what I took from this film was the lunacy and indifference of the high command, whether it was generals or politicians, that committed people to this slaughter, and then the deep sense of patriotism and comradeship that you find among the troops. The photography is really superb, and above all, I think the music counts for a great deal. In times of sadness, in times of tragedy, a song can pull you out of yourself. So towards the end of the film, we hear a clip of a bunch of soldiers singing Mademoiselle from Armentier, Parlez-vous. And we're going to come to that in a second because, again, it's a song which has stood the test of time. The other thing I associate with my own memories, and I had grandparents and great-uncles who were part of this huge tragedy, but also the poets. And if you read the poems of Siegfried Sassoon, Isaac Rogenberg, or Wilfred Owen, you have seen the visual images in the poetry come to life on this screen. Two tips. Arrive early and catch Peter Jackson's introduction to the movie. He gives a good insight on why war was declared and how it was fought. And then stay for his conclusion, which really does a lot of explaining about how the movie was made, how you convert old-time film into real-time action, and what colorizing really means. So here's that song we mentioned. It's a song the troops would sing after a R&R, a rest and a relaxation break in the small town of Armentières.
Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous? Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous? Mademoiselle from Armentières, she hasn't been kissed in 40 years. Inky dinky, parlez-vous? Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous?
Now, this is a very sad ending to the film, but I think it conveys what he set out to do. That is the futility of war, the value of peace, and above all, the meaning of comradeship. Now, totally different, we're moving from the theatre, from the movie theatre, to the stage. And last week, I spoke with playwright Lance Belleville about his upcoming play at the Ross Valley Players in Marin. And the play is called Scott and Zelda. It's the Fitzgerald story, subtitled Beautiful Fools. As a playwright, when we talked together, he explained that he wanted to get into the mindset of F. Scott Fitzgerald. And certainly for anybody who's read The Great Gatsby, there is plenty to rove around inside that very active mind. So what we have in this production, which opens on April the 12th and runs through to April 28th at Ross Valley Players, is a stream of consciousness taking the thoughts that went through Scott Fitzgerald's head and introducing some of the famous characters that he met along his way. This included people like Ernest Hemingway, his neighbour was Groucho Marx, and then with Zelda, there was, of course, the French lovers. And inside that romance, a strange romance, which really goes from New York to Tinseltown, from literally America to Europe, we begin to understand through the playwright's eyes what is the story behind this really strange and provocative marriage, a relationship that in many ways was explained both in the novels of Scott Fitzgerald and also in The Great Gatsby and other writings. Lynn Lowe is the director. The play is called Scott and Zelda. It's subtitled The Beautiful Fools, and I think for anybody who enjoys what I consider to be one of the finest novels of the 20th century, this will bring insights. And I also want to congratulate Ross Valley Players. They're coming up on their 89th anniversary. They try new materials, new plays, and in this case we have 8 actors playing 20 different roles. Now, if you want to find out more, it's rossvalleyplayers.com. The play opens on April the 12th, and I think Lance has created a very provocative work that will get you more engaged in the great writing of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Thanks once again, Peter, for your contributions to Open Air. Well, the best laid plans of mice and men, I'm one of those categories, means we don't have time for Rose's brief review of Cirque du Soleil, which is now at the fairgrounds in San Jose through the 24th. Needless to say, we were both very enthusiastic about it. Go to cirquedusoleil.com for remaining tickets. It's a really inventive, incredibly acrobatic show and a fun evening out. Also, originally advertised for this week, we were going to be talking with playwright Lauren Yee about her work The Great Leap, which features B.D. Wong. We're going to throw that in next week as well. I'll also talk with Peter Callender about the African-American Shakespeare Company's production of Leslie Lee's Black Eagles, which Peter directs. And from the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, I'll talk with conductor Don Harms next week. That and more on next week's Open Air. A reminder that the shows are archived at kalw.org. If you've got a show suggestion, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Neil Swinkles produces the show. We'll try to get something on the calendar for your special event. Thanks again for listening.